The Big Picture program is sponsored by Steering Auto Inspector Car in Benoni, the thinking person's car dealership. Steering Auto, the home of pre-loved cars.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is AB Dauji and this is The Big Picture, broadcasting simultaneously on Radio Islam and Radio Al Ansar. So, how are all you wonderful people out there? I have to praise you, right? I have to butter you up because without you, I will have no program and I'll be speaking to myself, which is something I do quite a lot these days, parking by the posy and all. The Big Picture, the program in which we cut through the bull, lift the lid on fake news, turn the microscope on the Chorwan virus, pull the plug on Ullus, Alus, Mukhus, Mamparas, and other assorted donkeys. Yes, folks, a roller coaster ride through this wonderful, weird, crazy world. So, my fellow South Africans, fasten your seatbelts, put your seats in the upright position, and switch off your cell phones. The Big Picture is ready to blast off. So how's that for the introduction, Mamo? Exciting, ne? Just as exciting as I told you my life is at the moment. Busy, 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 Habibi. Very busy. Yes, folks, doing lots of traveling. Yeah, traveling. That's what I'm doing. The itinerary is very exciting. Wow, eh? Here it is. Cast aside the gently billowing duvet and touch down your feet onto the scintillating cool tiles. Let the feet slide into the welcoming slippers and take an unhurried walk into the body cleansing zone, also known as the bathroom. There you will experience the soft drizzle of a tropical forest paradise spring shower. From there you meander through the doorway and then an exhilarating walk down the stairs like a heart-stopping slow bungee jump. And then into the gourmet area, also known as the kitchen. Behold, a myriad of exotic delights await. Exploring a large cavernous treasure chest, also known as the fridge. You discover a magical array of mouth-watering foods to satisfy the most discerning palate. You extract a tantalizing earth-brown paste of legumes, also known as peanut butter. And there is the pure, undiluted sunshine in an egg-yellow-colored block that makes any bread come to life and is the extract of the gramnivorous ruminating quadruped with several stomachs, which is popularly known as the cow. Yes, folks, a block of butter. Tune in next week for another exciting episode of Travels Through My Posy. Well, dear listeners, as you can see, I'm suffering from chronic travel withdrawal symptoms. Hey, it's tough, I tell you. How long is this COVID going to hold us hostage, eh? How long? You know, I met Ghulam Bhai at the veg shop in Overport, and he said to me, Dauji, hey, Dauji, you know what? This is the first year that we won't be going to Paris because of COVID-19. Normally, we don't go because we can't afford it. Note to myself, next time you see Ghulam Bhai, look down and walk very fast. So yes, back to my hermit lifestyle. Highlight of my day is lunch. We're talking of Kari Khichdi here, Habibi. Kari Khichdi with the works. Next day is Methi Bhaji in mince with fresh roti. Following day, it's very likely mince curry, potato and peas with rice. Dear people, all this indulgence has had serious consequences for me. That's right. stomach problems, Habibi. No, it's got nothing to do with indigestion or Eno's or anything of that sort. Bending down to cut my toenails or tying my shoelace is very problematic, considering that the pet is deciding to have an independent life of its own. Very, very traumatic indeed. Haven't seen my toes for months. Now, I must admit that eating is my pet project. Pet project. You got that? Not pet. Pet. Pet project. Did you get that, eh? Mota? Never mind, eh? Your fro will explain it to you. Well, as you must have gathered by now, I like good, traditional, authentic Indian food. I am not for one for the pasta and a casta and a casserole and broccoli bake or creamy cauliflower with cheese topping. Hey, man. No. My whole digestive system is tuned to only accept tarkaris and such. The only thing that is non-Indian that I like is chips, which all you posh people out there prefer to call French fries. I must have polished off maybe 1,000 pockets of potatoes made into chips that I had from Solly's Corner when I lived in Johannesburg. Actonville, hair-raising, Habibi, hair-raising. Please give salams to Yunus if any of you go to Solly's Corner. Which brings me to the point about chips. I'd like to go to New York to have a plate of chips at the Serendipity 3 restaurant. Did you get that? I'd like to go to New York to have a plate of chips at the Serendipity 3 restaurant. So, what's so special about the plate of chips, I hear you ask, Mr. Impatient Mota? Well, the fact is the chips served at this upmarket restaurant has made it into the Guinness Book of Records. Wow, can you believe it? A plate of French fries featured in the Guinness Book of Records? Very, very strange indeed. And the question is, how come? Well, it's not just any old plate of chips from your regular, what you get here from your chicken place. No, sirree. These chips are completely in their own league, their own category, mamo. A work of art. But on second thoughts, I don't think I'll go over to New York to have the chips, because I just discovered that this plate of chips is not Sanha approved. It contains a dash of Daru. So, without any further ado, my fellow South Africans, here is a description of this record-breaking, unique plate of chips as reported on the Business Insider website. Right, so let's see what we got for you. It all starts with sliced upstate Chipperbeck potatoes that get blanched in a bath of Dom Perignon champagne and J. Leblanc French champagne ardent vinegar, the restaurant says. The potatoes are then fried in premium French goose fat before being seasoned with Grande truffle salt and tossed in Urbani summer oil. They then get topped with shaved Crete Senesi Pecorino cheese from the milk of sheep that graze on the clay-rich hills of Crete Senesi, dotted with black truffles foraged from valleys and forests in the Volterra and Minato, Italy. Lastly, they are topped with shaved Italian black summer truffles and sprinkled with 23 carat gold dust. Sprinkled with 23 carat gold dust. To top it all off, the fries are served with a side of Mornay dipping sauce made from udder cream from Jersey cows, black truffle butter, and Gruyere truffle. Swiss raclette. The dish was created by Serendipity 3 corporate chef Frederick Schwan Kiewart and creative director Joe Calderone. And so they say, we are so honored to be recognized by Guinness World Records for our creation of the creme de la creme pommes frites. Mm. Okay, let me say this, Habibi. If I took a few of my friends, let me just see you here, but hang on. Well, it's listed on the menu, as I said, at the restaurant at Crème de la Crème Pommes Frites. Now, Pommes Frites is spelled P-O-M-M-E-S-F-R-I-T-E-S. Of course, it's French and it's spelled, as I told you now, but pronounced Pommes Frites. These French eat up half their words, eh? So it's not pommes frites, it's pommes frites. Next time you Lanis go to the posh restaurant in Amplanga, you can show off and tell the waiter that you will have poisson and pommes frites. There you go. Poisson is spelled, well, it's actually fish and chips. Poisson is fish and pommes frites is chips. Right, so poisson is spelled P-O-I-S-S-O-N. Right? So you better be very careful how you pronounce that word because he might just bring something that will kill you. So there you are. Poisson, poisson. Hmm? You don't pronounce the whole word. Half the word is chowed up. Ish, the French eat everything inside. Snails, which they call escargot. Escargot. And it's spelled E-S-C-A-R-G-O-T, not escargot. Escargot. The tea is chowed up. And they, of course, chow frogs' legs, which they say, is pronounced like this. Crise de grenouille. It's like somebody choking you when you're speaking. It's spelled, you won't believe it, C-R-U-I-S-S-E-S-D-E-G-R-E-N-O-R-O-U-I-L-L-E-S. And pronounce Crise de Grenouille. This is enough of these French lessons. My tongue is getting sprained here. And the chips are getting cold. So I gave you the full description. Okay, let me say this, Habibi. You got the whole rundown, right? With the 23 karat gold dust. If I took a few of my friends to this restaurant and ordered a plate of this crème de la crème pommes frites, when the waiter brings me the bill, I'll really have my chips. Because the price of a plate of this chips is, are you ready? Can you guess? It's $200. Yes, $200. That's about 3,000 rands. So if four of us go there, the bill will be 12,000 rands. Okay, just one more thing. If my chomis decide to order a sandwich and milkshake and dessert, I'm sunk. I'll have to sell my house to pay the bill because these three items also made it into the Guinness Book of Records. But wait, hang on. If you want to have just the plate of chips, you have to call 48 hours in advance to place your order. And guess what? If you do want to chow there, there may be a slight problem, a small problem. There is already a waiting list. A waiting list, boss, for a 3,000 rand plate of chips. You know what? I wish I was a buddy of the Kaji Lighties. Eh? I don't know if I should mention. Shame, eh? These Bitcom boys really got themselves into the soup. I just read an article this morning that sometime before 21-year-old Amir left South Africa, he bought a second-hand car. Second-hand. Shame. I'm sure he could have afforded a new one. But times are tight these days, Habibi. Very, very tough. So he bought a second-hand Lamborghini Huracan. In Italian, it's pronounced Hurrican. Hey, I don't want to give you an Italian lesson now. Yeah, Lamborghini Hurrican. And he paid for it in cash. How much? How much? Not a bad price, actually. 4.75 million rands. Did your eyes just pop out? But ach, shame, you know, it still needed some extra things. So a 60,000 rand exhaust system was fitted and a spoiler for only 300,000 rands. What a great deal, eh? Ish, this whole Bitkom story is full of intrigue and it'll possibly end badly. And too much of stress, unfortunately, for their family. And let me just leave it there. So let's stay local, which is not too lekker, hey, Brazo? Not too lekker. South Africa can also make it into the Guinness Book of Records. We have the greatest number of mamparas in the world. And the number one character for the title of Ulu of the Week is a chap called Jackie Shandu. I think a more accurate name would be Jackie Gandu. Yeah, Jackie Gandu. By now, you must have seen the video of him standing on the steps of the City Hall in Durban. And, well, he was chanting. He was chanting, one settler, one bullet. One Indian, one bullet. And his supporters happily repeated it. And there was one kurta fella there also. Ish. Well, Jackie Shandu, may not have realized one thing when he was doing this, that to shout such word is a very, very serious offense, a crime. It's an incitement to violence, very serious indeed. Well, later in the day, the storm must have broken over his head and he realized that this is a crime. So he, while sitting in his car, said, "Hey, I made a mistake. I'm not a racist, so I withdraw my words." "Well, it's too late, boss. Charges have been laid at a police station by the social activist Viswan Reddy," very sharp guy this, "and by Ashwin Trikamzi of the South African Hindu Mahasabha, and has been reported to the Human Rights Commission by Action South Africa, the party of Senator Mustafa Darsot, famous for the big picture." So, yes, that is the big picture regarding Jackie Shandu. No doubt having sleepless night. Well, this guy really takes the cake. In fact, I think he has hijacked the whole bakery. The subtext I've read somewhere is the allegation that he was expelled from the EFF. Well, my thinking is that Shandu decided that he will outdo Malema in tough talk, abrasive talk, bluster, especially regarding Indians. And so at the steps of the City Hall, he thought that he would make his mark, raise his image, make himself a big shot politician, and that we would notice. Well, he may just disappear completely into obscurity in the place called Tronk. But wait, dear people. Shouldn't the state itself be laying a charge? You know, just a week or so ago, they carted off the former DJ guy. What's his name? Ngizwe Nkunu. Cutting him up to jail for allegations that he instigated violence for speeches he said to have made before the looting began, and so on. So it's the same situation, yes? Hey? This Shandu did exactly the same thing, and two cops were actually standing right near him as he spoke. The state should have arrested him. That's my, well, not so informed legal view, but that's what I think. Imagine if I was standing outside City Hall and shouted, "All black people must be shot." Good heavens, within 10 seconds, cops would appear and cut me off. And in no time, I'll be in orange overalls and eating brown bread with thick jam and my black tea and a mug of black tea. Anyway, let's leave that, okay? Let's leave that. Yes, so I mentioned two things, Malema and looting. You know, everybody is trying to make sense of what happened over that fateful week when there was wholesale death and destruction, looting and burnings, chaos, fear and anger and shame. Yes, shame. South Africa descending into anarchy. We were all gobsmacked, taken aback, depressed and dismayed. One commentator who is very sharp and calls a spade and not a soil-turning garden implement is Justice Malala. Sharp as a menorah, I tell you, Habibi. Some of you Balis will remember that name. Justice Malala, in his straight-talking, incisive manner, wrote a piece that I thought unpacked the situation brilliantly. Listen carefully, Mota. Okay? Don't go off to the kitchen for tea or something. Listen here. I'm going to read this thing. I think it is very, very well put. So he says, They will lie to you, these fake revolutionaries. They will send your children to die in a burning mall, these fake Che Guevaras and fake Marxists, and tell you you are fighting the struggle. Then they will put on their Armani suits and sip I suppose that's some kind of a drink, while you mourn your dead son and pitiable daughter. I am talking about the fake revolutionaries who sent at least 337 of our people to the undignified deaths in shopping malls, on the streets, in cold and lonely places, in stampedes under the feet of others, while these alleged leaders and their families sat in their warm mansions and sent out tweets to inflame, incite, and ultimately send the poor to their deaths. These people are no different to many others we have seen before. They loot the state, look after their own, and use the poor as fodder when the long arm of the law starts getting close to them. What do you do if you have nothing meaningful to contribute to society that has set itself specific goals and is achieving them? You create chaos. You undermine and break everything society values until there is nothing but mayhem. Then you force that community to beg you to stop. Most of our analysis of the circle of avarice, called the Radical Economic Transformation faction of the ANC and its hate manufacturers on social media, particularly Twitter and Facebook, is wrong. We ascribed a great vision, planning and motives to them. We say they want this or that. We are wrong. They want chaos. Theirs is a totally different world. Selfish, uncaring, cynical, and ultimately megalomaniac. It is the world of me, me, me. They don't care about the poor, the marginalized, or the weak. They see such people as mere fodder for their cynical and ruthless grab for power. They want chaos because in disorder they can loot and oppress and get away with it. Chaos and lawlessness are their natural habitat. Take the Twitter feed of former President Jacob Zuma's daughter, Duduzile Sambudla Zuma. 2 weeks ago, this Twitter account was encouraging and applauding the looting and destruction of property taking place across the country. It was one of the first to glorify the torching of trucks on the N2, N3 highway. As the mayhem spread, so did Sambudla Zuma's joy in the feed. "We see you," she tweeted to the looters. Just days later, she acted all outraged about what happened in Phoenix, a predominantly Indian suburb in KwaZulu-Natal, where vigilante groups allegedly killed Sihle Zikalala's count, 38 black people. Police Minister Bekitele has quite correctly appointed a 10-man detective team to investigate and bring those responsible to book. Now, in my book, the person who encouraged and applauded the mayhem and looting is responsible for the deaths of most, if not all, of the 337 people who died during these riots. If desperately poor people left their cold homes because the daughter of the former president said it's all right to go out and loot, then who should be responsible? The way I see it, with every tweet and every voice note, these influential people, and Zuma Sambudla in particular, were doing what the Hutu radio station did in 1994 in Rwanda. Every sane, rational person would know this. Zuma Sambudla should know this. Yet, In their crocodile tears, Zuma Sambudla and her ilk are very happy to go on without accepting that they might bear some responsibility for what happened. It is the same as EFF leader Julius Malema and his Red Brigade. These people were applauding Malema when he said if the state deploys troops, then he too was joining in. Joining in what? Looting? Destroying property? What exactly was this serial flip-flopper who once said he wanted to see Zuma, Jacob Zuma, suffer buying into? The issue is beyond Zuma's daughter, of course. It is this entire brigade which styles itself on radical economic transformation. They want chaos, they want mayhem, they want lawlessness. They claim to want justice for the people who died in Phoenix, but do not want justice for the people who suffered for the theft of billions through state capture. Crucially, they want the rest of us to follow them and not get to the serious work of rebuilding the country. So this past weekend, they were jumping up and down, blaming President Cyril Ramaphosa and Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan for the events in Phoenix. The truth is, they don't care about the black people who died in Phoenix. They just want to point at South Africans of Indian origin and inflame racial and ethnic tensions. They seek chaos, not justice. They seek madness, not rationality. They thrive in the sewer. That is what we are faced with. These people must never come to power again. Whoa! Hey, I tell you, man, Justice Malala. What you make of that, eh, Habibi? Brilliant stuff from a sharp guy. Justice Malala saying it like it is. Okay, get this. You know what? Let me tell you this. Malema is not stupid. In fact, he is brilliant. And all the top boys in the EFF, they all have degrees. Mbuyiseni Ndlozi has a PhD, Nohal. PhD in political science from Wits University. Floyd Shivambu has a master's degree with distinction in political studies. And our man, Julius, has a BA in communications and African languages. So don't have the mistaken impression that these are, as my grandfather would say, chapanyas. No, not at all. Don't make that mistake. They are very, very smart, very intelligent guys. Malema built up a party from nothing at all, pushed out of the ANC. It was a one-man show, and now, 8 years later, their birthday was last week, the EFF has 44 seats in parliament. Quite amazing, I must admit. So, what these top boys in the EFF, what these top boys say, is this not random talk? No. They know exactly what they say to attract the masses, the voters. The strategy is well planned. When they see that there is a large group, a constituency, whose vote they can get, they say things that will appeal to that group. Now, it's all politics, eh? It's done everywhere. These are not the exceptions. In America, the Republican Party says nice things to the huge gun lobby. We are with you. No law, no one will take your guns away. And so, these gun tooters vote for the Republican Party. So here's a very simple a very simple example, maybe even a silly one. If a large group, say 1 million people, say that they are opposed to mustaches, then the EFF will exploit that situation. We stand with the people against mustaches. It is a colonial imposition on our people. White people came here with mustaches, and now we were made to accept their culture. We reject it. How will a mustache raise our people from poverty? It is useless. It is a radical face transformation from Europe. It's white monopoly culture, and we black people say no to mustaches. We stand with Pam. Yes, Pam. People against mustaches. I'm saying it in a very funny way, but generally this is how political parties behave. And may I say, the EFF does an excellent job in appealing to the hopes of the broad electorate. It's all about votes, Habibi. All about votes. And it's a very old formula. Tell the people what they like to hear and you may get their votes. It's very easy to make all kinds of attractive promises when you are not in power. That's the name of the game. Politics, Habibi, politics. And I suppose all parties, all politicians play the game very well. But you know what? Maybe I got my eye on one party. Herman Mashaba's Action Front. Action Front SA. He seems very, very clean, untouched by scandal and corruption. So let's see how he goes and how the party goes. And of course, the formidable Senator Darsot is there to keep an eye on things. Now, let's have a quick look at other stories. The ice cream war. Yeah, Israel pulling out the big guns. Remember the old Tom and Jerry cartoons where Tom the cat was always chasing Jerry the mouse? Well, it's something like that with Israel pursuing the Ben and Jerry ice cream company, that's the American ice cream company, which, as I told you last week, decided to stop selling its world-famous ice cream in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, which Israel captured in 1967, and which the world regarded as occupied territory, and where in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, Israel has built huge, huge housing estates for Israeli Jews. So, no ice cream for them in the occupied territory. The whole thing will come to an end in 18 months. They'll stop selling ice cream in those areas. Meanwhile, Israel is working full swing to get the company to change its mind. And let me read this to you. This week it was reported that Israel had formed a special task force designed to pressure Ben and Jerry's and its parent company Unilever into backing down. A classified Israeli foreign ministry cable declared, "We need to make use of the 18 months that are left until the decision comes into force and try to change it. We want to create long-term pressure on Unilever and Ben and Jerry's by consumers, politicians, and in the press and social media in order to lead to a dialogue with the companies." Among other actions, the memo reportedly tells Israeli diplomats, in its words, to encourage Jewish organizations, pro-Israeli advocacy groups, and evangelical, that's Christian evangelical communities, to organize demonstrations in front of Ben and Jerry's and Unilever's offices in an effort to pressure the corporation and their investors. Our cousins don't play, Habibi. They don't play. You don't mess with them. They sort you out one shot in no time. So what will happen? Now, I'm not a gambling man, Molana, but I'm prepared to bet 1 million Zim dollars that within 18 months, Ben and Jerry will back down. Tom will eventually get Jerry. And here's the effervescent Mehdi Hassan, putting the whole thing into perspective in just 60 seconds. Let me play the clip for you.
Welcome back. It's time now for what I call the 60-second rant. Start the clock. The reaction from top Israelis to Ben and Jerry's ice cream pulling out of the occupied Palestinian territories has been both hilarious and rather revealing. Former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tweeted, "Now we Israelis know which ice cream not to buy." Israel's President Isaac Herzog declared that the boycott against Israel is a new type of terrorism, economic terrorism, terrorism that seeks to harm Israeli citizens and the Israeli economy. And Israel's Foreign Minister Yair Lapid warned the ice cream makers that they would not treat the state of Israel like this without a response. First off, thank you, Mr. Netanyahu, for telling us that you now support the idea of boycotts too. Congratulations. Second, Mr. Israeli President calling an ice cream company's decision not sell ice cream. Terrorism is an insult to every victim of actual violent terrorism, including Israeli victims. And third, Mr. Israeli Foreign Minister, you kind of said the quiet part loud. You and your president say Ben & Jerry's is hurting Israel and its economy. But Ben & Jerry's said they would only stop selling ice cream inside illegal Israeli settlements. They say they're staying put inside of Israel. So you clearly consider the occupied territory to be part of the state of Israel. And see, if that's the case and the Palestinians there cannot vote in Israeli elections, then by your own admission, you are now an apartheid state. So it's a simple choice. It's either no to the ice cream or yes to apartheid. You choose.
Well, 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 there you are. And please don't send any hard claps my way. I didn't realize that there's some sort of background music to that clip. But yes, this guy, Mehdi Hassan, is a real menorah. Eh? But there are two things he said that I didn't think about. Firstly, Israel says that Ben and Jerry, that B&J's decision is a war on Israel. Well, the company is not pulling out of Israel itself, just the occupied territory. So if Israel considers the occupied territories as also part of Israel, then it must give the vote to all the people living there. And if it does not give it to the Palestinians, that is the vote, then that is apartheid. Did you get that? Just think about it, right? Secondly, Israel says that boycotts like the BDS movement are not good. They don't solve anything. And now Israel is calling on its supporters in the U.S. to boycott B&J. Wonderful stuff, isn't it? Anyway, let's still stay in Israel. Now, we generally get very bad stories. Bad stories coming out of there. For example, a 12-year-old boy, Muhammad Al-Alami, was shot while in his father's car. If I got time, I'll tell you the story about that. That was and at his funeral, Israeli forces fired on the mourners, and a 43-year-old man was shot and died. All in the past week. So far, 77 children have been killed by the Israeli army this year alone. Since the beginning of this year. But guess what? There is an amazing good news story coming out of there. Absolutely incredible. A good news story for a change. Let me read to you the Associated Press article dated 28 July, just 1 or 2 days ago. Listen very carefully. A very, very touching story. It got me all choked up when I read it. And I hope I don't get... I'm a bit of a softie when I read all these touching stories. Right. Sorry about that. And that wasn't a COVID cough, inshallah. Right. So here's the story. Idit Harel Sigal, an Israeli lady, was turning 50. And she had chosen a gift. She was going to give one of her own kidneys to a total stranger. The kindergarten teacher from northern Israel, a proud Israeli, hoped that her choice would set an example of generosity in a land of perpetual conflict. She was spurred by memories of her late grandfather, a Holocaust survivor, who told her to live meaningfully, and by Jewish tradition, which holds that there is no higher duty than saving a life. So, Idit Sigal contacted a group that links donors and recipients, launching a 9-month process to transfer her kidney to someone who needed one. Now, get this very clear. She just went to that organization to donate her kidney, and she didn't know who they would give it to. That someone turned out to be a 3-year-old Palestinian boy from the Gaza Strip. You don't know me, but soon we'll be very close because my kidney will be in your body. Sigal wrote in Hebrew to the boy, whose family asked not to be named due to the sensitivities over cooperating with Israelis. A friend translated the letter into Arabic so the family might understand. I hope with all my heart
that this surgery will succeed and you will live a long and healthy and meaningful life, she wrote. Just after the 11-day war, she wrote, I threw away the anger and frustration and see only one thing. I see hope for peace and love. And if there will be more like us, there won't be anything to fight over. What unfolded over the months between Sigal's decision and the June 16 transplant, right? So it happened already on June 16. What transpired was that it caused deep rifts in the family, right? They didn't know who this kidney was going to. They just heard that she wants to donate a kidney to that organization that takes the donations. Her husband and the oldest of her three children, a son in his early 20s, opposed the plan. Her father stopped talking to her. To them, Sigal recalled, she was unnecessarily risking her life. The loss of three relatives in Palestinian attacks, including her father's parents, made it even more difficult. Right? She couldn't tell them that her kidney was going to go to Palestine. My family was really against it. Right? Just the idea of giving the kidney. Forget about the Palestinian boy. Just the idea of donating a kidney to the organization. She says, my family was really against it. Everyone was against it. My husband, my sister, her husband. And the one who supported me the least was my father, Sigal said during a recent interview. They were afraid. Yes, of course, they were afraid that if she gives one kidney away, maybe the other will get infected or something and she could die. So they were afraid that she was just donating. As I said, at that stage, they only knew that she wanted to donate a kidney and they were against it. They didn't know that it was going to a Palestinian child. When she learned the boy's identity, right, that a kidney would be going to this boy, she kept the details to herself for months. I told no one, Sigal recalled. I told myself, if the reaction to the kidney donation is so harsh, so obviously the fact that a Palestinian boy is getting it will make it even harsher. And Israel has maintained a tight blockade over the Gaza Strip since Hamas, an Islamic militant group that opposes Israel's existence, seized control of the area in 2007. The bitter enemies have fought four wars since then, and few Gazans are allowed to enter Israel. With Gaza's healthcare system ravaged by years of conflict and blockade, Israel grants entry permits to a small number of medical patients in need of serious treatment on humanitarian grounds. Matnat Chaim, a non-governmental organization in Jerusalem, coordinated the exchange, said the group's chief executive, Sharona Sherman. The case of the Gaza boy was complicated. To speed up the process, his father, who was not a match for his son, was told by the hospital that if he were to donate a kidney to an Israeli recipient, the boy would immediately go to the top of the list. Right, let me just explain that. If the boy had to wait, he would have to wait and wait on a long list that was there. Now, the boy's father's kidney was no match, so that he couldn't donate to his son. But if he decided to give his one kidney to this organization, then the boy would immediately go to the top of the list. So on the same day that his son received a new kidney, the father donated one of his own. And where did it go to? To a 25-year-old Israeli mother of two. In some countries, reciprocal arrangement, that is, I give something to you and you give something to me. And in this case, it's about the kidney. So it is not permitted because it raises the question of whether the donor has been coerced, has been forced. The whole ethic of organ donation is based on the principle that the donors should give of their own free will and get nothing in return. In Israel, the father's donation is seen as an incentive to increase the pool of donors. For Sigal, this lady, the gift that had sparked such a conflict in her family accomplished more than she hoped. Wow, listen to this. Her kidney has helped save the boy's life, generated a second donation that is by the boy's father, and established new links between members of perpetually warring groups in one of the world's most intractable conflicts. She said she visited the boy on the eve of his surgery and maintains contact with his parents. Sigal said she honored her grandfather in a way that helps her cope with the grief of his death 5 years ago. The donation was an act of autonomy, she said, and she never wavered, never thought twice about it. And eventually her family came around, a gift perhaps in itself. So her family accepted this. They came around. And for her, that was a gift in itself. She said her husband understands better now, as do her children. And on the eve of Segal's surgery, her father called her. Remember, her father wasn't speaking to her just because she wanted to give to donate a kidney to that organization. He didn't even know it was going to. And he stopped talking to her because he was afraid that she was doing the wrong thing. So on the eve of Segal's surgery, her father called her. And Sigal said, "I don't remember what he said," because he was crying. Then she told him that her kidney was going to a Palestinian boy. For a moment, there was silence. And then her father spoke. He said, "Well, he needs a life also." You know what? This lady, Edith Harel Sigal, should be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, especially because there is so much animosity, so much hate for one side, for the other. And therefore, to take such a bold, such a courageous step is absolutely mind-blowing. I'm sure you'll agree. So, dear listeners, at last, a very beautiful story, a heartwarming story from a region of endless, painful, ugly stories. Isn't that a nice note to end on? I'm going to try to get the contact details of both families and give it to you maybe, inshallah, next week. And so maybe you can drop them a line or say how moved you are by what they managed to accomplish. Heartwarming. That's the word, heartwarming. Right, let's go now to the graveyard of the light at the end of the tunnel. I got some danya here. I'm going to sprinkle it on this old story here from the light at the end of the tunnel. And all right, pretend that you never heard it before. And some of you motas out there, well, like me, your memories are going. So just laugh out loudly, okay? Right, but let's see, I've got 2 minutes or 3 minutes left. Let me read you first. Normally when I get some nice cute sayings and SMS or emails and so on, some sweet sugary sayings, the inspiring quotations that flood your WhatsApp, I just delete them without even reading them. But one I received last night was, I thought, quite deep. This is what it said. "Two things define you: your patience when you have nothing, and your attitude when you have everything." One more thing. If you want to create happiness, then seek that which enriches your life. But if you want to experience happiness, then help others enrich theirs. All right. Now, finally, you know, sometimes these vegetarian types can really get on your nerves, eh? Especially those who have just recently given up eating meat. They are on a crusade. They have this holier-than-thou attitude. Keep talking about it. Keep talking about how. Well, there was this vegetarian sitting at a table in the new restaurant in Overport City, in the mall. At the other table was Ghulam Bhai from Mir Bank. And as we know, Ghulam Bhai is not noted for being discreet or diplomatic. The vegetarian, that's a lady, she stood up from the huge bowl of salad that she was eating and she said, "You know, a sheep died so you could have that burger." And Ghulam Bhai looked up at her salad and said, "Hey, madam, maybe he died because you keep eating all his food." One quick one. Yeah, last Friday, I saw a very serious small boy making dua. He finished off by saying, "And please, please make Durban the capital of South Africa. Please make Durban the capital of South Africa." Well, when he finished making the dua, I said, "Hey, why you were making dua for Durban to be made the capital of South Africa?" And he answered, "Because, uncle, that is what I wrote in my exam paper this morning." This is A.B. Dawji bidding you all assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.